Thanks, Eileen. Thank you very much. There, Alan.
Yeah. It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Good afternoon on this Wednesday afternoon, 51551 on ray@rte.ie. I was just getting the stats together. Well, we were just getting the stats together on the tallest buildings in Ireland over the years. And it's a race to the top. It's a race to the top between Dublin and Cork. I'm looking at it here. For years, Cork County Hall at 67 metres, built in 1968, was the tallest building in Ireland. And then 2010, according to our sources, now you might correct me, according to our sources here, then in 2010, Google Docs was built, 67 metres, similar, just edged above it. And then the Elysian in Cork regained the crown at 71 metres in 2008. Then the Capitol Dock in Dublin says, ha-ha, we'll see your 71 metres and we'll go 8 metres high, 79 metres and 22 stories. And now the new one down in Cork, don't think it has a name yet, is going to be 34 stories high. So it's going to dwarf all those other ones. But I was just looking, remember we had that chat about the chimneys in Pool Beg? They're 207.8 metres tall. I know they're not buildings and I know they don't have apartments or anything else in them, but they are the tallest structures. They must be the tallest structures in Ireland at 207.8 metres, which is what? Nearly three times taller than the Capitol Dock in Dublin. And thanks to everybody who sent us in photographs and books and paintings of the chimneys from Pool Beg after we spoke about it. They're up there on my desk. I must give them an honorary mention before the end of the week. So that's it. So it was Cork, then Dublin, then Cork, then Dublin, and now it's going to be Cork again for the tallest building in Ireland. Of course, everything's better down there, isn't it? I was watching a documentary about dance music on RTE1 on Monday night, and Sir Henry's in Cork was the best place for dance music in the 90s. That's what they said anyway. It's Cork, always the best, always the best. The best market, the best this, the best that, the best accent. How are you? 51551 or ray@rte.ie. I'm a big fan of the Greenways and I was very excited when I opened up the paper this morning and saw the launch of 130 kilometres Royal Canal Greenway offers hope for business. And it's from Maynooth to Clundra in County Longford. And you're probably saying to yourself, where's Clundra? See, I know, because I was there. Yeah, back in July 2019, we were on our tour of the Hidden Heartlands and it brought us to this lovely scenic little village on the Grand Canal. It was actually on the confluence of the Shannon and the Grand Canal and it's called Clundra, but it's spelt Clundara. So you'll know people have been there because they get the pronunciation correct. Other people be going, I'm off to Clundara. No, you're not. You're going to Clundra. That's where you're going. Anyway, so it starts at Maynooth and it's going to end there in Clundra. And I'm just looking at the picture there in the Irish Times. And if you're looking at it there and you see it, there's a blue and white boat. We were sort of did the show, the whole show from a barge, which was the other side of that. And it was a rainy day and we started in the barge. And such was the wooden panelling and the low ceiling that it actually sounded like we were in studio. The acoustics were brilliant. And we had a live performance from Aslan and we met various people. And one of the people we met was a local, Hugh Hickey. And Hugh Hickey grew up in the lockkeeper's house in Clundra. And he was one of 13 children. And we have a chat with him. He was sitting there and we were chatting away. Funny man, a barge man. And I was talking to him about growing up in Clundra and what it was like.
From the time nearly when I was born,
yeah,
I was a small child, there's been visitors coming here. Always anglers, English anglers come for 30, 40 years.
It's
when we were kids growing up.
It's a beautiful part of the country.
It is, yeah. It is.
Yeah, and I'd say most of the people, listen, prior to today, had never heard of Clundra.
Probably not.
No.
And that's the way we like it.
Oh, no. Well, you see, this is our job. We're telling people about Clundra.
That's the way we like it.
And we're telling people to come here on their holidays.
Look at the crowd you've just brought.
Yeah, sorry about that. I apologise.
The only good thing is that you're leaving.
And being at the confluence of the Royal Canal and the River Shannon, has that in any way coloured your personality?
Not really, no.
No,
I'm just, this is normal. No.
The Royal Canal, not the Grand Canal. And that's Hugh Hickey there. He won't be happy about the Greenway on its way to Clundra. I think his tongue was firmly placed in his cheek. We had a good day that day. And I look forward to cycling from Maynooth to Clundra. We must do a tour of the greenways. That's what we'll do. Yes, when lockdown's over. We had great plans at the beginning of 2020 and people had all sorts of plans for weddings and all sorts of things. Our plan was to get out and about. And at one stage we were talking about getting to a different place in the country every week. Now we reined that in and the plan was to get to a different place in the country every 2 or 3 weeks. And we'd all sorts of plans and we'd started in Stonyford and down in County Kilkenny and then whoop, lockdown. You're going nowhere. You're going nowhere. So that's scuppered that. But when it's open again, we and maybe the greenways would be a good place. We could go to Clondragh again or someplace along that greenway. We can go down to Waterford, maybe go from Kilmacthomas or someplace like that, or Kilmeaden. And then we could go the Westport one, the Achill. We could do it from Achill or maybe Newport or someplace along there. And there's other ones all over the country. That'd be a good little tour of the country. Cycling away as we go. It's a thing that comes up over and over again on radio programmes. People who can't manage to pass their driving test. And I remember we had a lady, I think she had done it 12 or 14 times. And we got this person who was supposed to be brilliant as an instructor. And as it turned out, they were, because they helped that person pass their test on the 14th or 15th attempt. Anyway, if you're one of those people who have failed and failed and failed again, and your driving test is a monkey on your back. And that's part of the problem we established back then with psychologists, because we spoke to them about it. See, the more times you do it, the bigger an issue it becomes, the more likely you are to be nervous on the day, which is going to interfere with your driving. Anyway, there's a man now age 50 who has failed his driving test, wait for it, 192 times. He's a Polish man. 192 times. So I can't imagine there's anybody in this country who has failed their test that much. So that'll be consolation for people around the country. 192. Oh, the poor man. Just get a chauffeur. Just like the amount of money he's put into that over the years. We were talking to Alice yesterday, the cat detective. I really enjoyed her. She was an amazing woman. She has studied cat behaviour and she is the only woman I've met and spoken to over the years that actually can get inside the head of an animal. She was able to think like a cat. And she was telling us all sorts of things. Like cats usually don't go beyond, was it 500 metres of their home? They're not like other animals. They don't wander off. Anyway, on the back of that, I see a story from the UK where a missing cat has been reunited with family after 14 years. What she did say to us, that a lot of cats have a number of families. So they'll go where they're fed. And they can take on various names very quickly. So you might call it Rusty. Somebody else might call it Ginger. But Rusty or Ginger, they don't mind as long as they're getting fed. Call me anything as long as you're giving me food. Anyway, the Batemans on the Isle of Wight said Jess went missing after we let him out. Let him out into the garden. After a month, they thought they gave up on it. Anyway, what happened was that Jess went down the road to the local nursing home and found a home there. And when the nursing home thought that Jess needed more care 13 years on and must have advertised him for a new home, the Batemans spotted and they realised that that was their cat from 13 years ago and now they're back together again. Jess is 17. Isn't that a lovely story? It's a lovely story. I'm sure you've all made a mad purchase online during lockdown. It's a bit of diversion, isn't it? We can't go window shopping and we can't go out and, you know, buy those little treats for ourselves. So we go online and we, you know, and sometimes you buy it and you buy it when you've a few glasses of wine in you and you go, why did I order that? And sometimes you buy something that's very useful. Anyway, the latest thing, I saw this on Twitter. Well, Niamh saw it on Twitter. Wife ordered a bed washing up sponge holder. Do you know those scouring sponges? The yellow at the bottom and then the green bit at the top for scouring your pots and pans. Yeah. Well, imagine if you had a miniature plastic bed with a headboard and all and you place that in it and then put two little pillows on top of it to make it look like a bed. Is that useless or what? And you put that on the windowsill beside the sink. Yeah. I'm sure it's not the daftest thing that people have bought. It's not the daftest thing at all. Lemmy. Remember Lemmy from Motorhead? Yeah, you must remember Motorhead. Yeah. Oh. Yeah, he was all rockstar, was Lemmy from Motorhead. He died in 2015. They've now revealed that he got his ashes put into gold bullets. And he gave them out. Well, he didn't, but his family gave them out to his friends and associates. And there's a picture there of a gold bullet with Lemmy written on it. And his ashes are inside. That's an interesting one. We've spoken to people who've had ashes of their loved ones in lockets or in little stones, little pieces of glass. I think there are people who do that for you. I've never seen it in a bullet before. What would you, I don't know, yeah, because I am going to be cremated. I'm saying it now. I am going to be cremated when I go. I haven't decided what I want people to do with my ashes yet. Do I want them strewn over the sea somewhere nice? Do I want them to bring them up to the Wicklow Mountains and thrown against the wind? Do I want them buried in the back garden? Do I want them put into an old cassette? Maybe an old cassette. Put them into an old cassette. And no, I don't know. Have you decided what you're going to do with your ashes if you're getting cremated? 5 on 551 RadioRT.ie. And we look enviously at New Zealand. And the latest picture to come out of New Zealand is a crowded house concert. Take the weather with you. And there they are in glorious sunshine with their sun hats on, sitting around like it was Slane or the Electric Picnic or someplace like that, in their thousands, no masks, sunshine, music, beer, all of that. And if we had done things differently, no, we wouldn't be there because it's the middle of March and we can't shut off our borders like they did in New Zealand because we're attached to another country, whether we like it or not. And in that country, as in the UK, now up there in Northern Ireland, they have the tallest building on the island of Ireland. Did you know that? The Grand Central Hotel in Belfast is 80 metres high. So it's only in the Republic that this new building will be the highest, unless it trumps that one at 80, 85 metres. Tall chimneys. The chimneys in Money Point, Kilrush, County Clare are over 700 feet high, taller than Poole Beg. Are they? They are. Fact check, the power station chimneys at 218 are the tallest freestanding structures in Ireland. Thank you very much. So there you go. They beat Poole Beg chimneys by about 10 metres. And I'm a dub, but Poole Beg chimney height is 207.8 metres or 681 feet 9 inches. Money Point power station chimney, 700 feet. So it's 19 feet taller. There you go. You forgot to mention what would be the most beautiful greenway in Ireland, the South Kerry Greenway, running from Glen Bay to Carrisafeane along the beautiful coastline, looking over Dingle Bay. We'd really appreciate you mentioning it. There it is, Lucy. And I'll be one of the first people down to cycle on that when it's eventually open. They had a few problems over the years, didn't they? I think it's going ahead now. But you might inform me, Lucy, about that. If you would, thank you very much. 51551ray@rte.ie. I've played that. I'll play this. Oh, no. I'll do the quiz after this song. I'll wake you up. Knock the cobwebs off. 51551ray@rte.ie. The actor James Doohan, who played Scott on the original Star Trek. I can't do it, Captain. Terrible impersonation, had his ashes smuggled up into space onto the International Space Station. His son admitted that recently. Best and fitting place for a legend for his ashes to boldly go where no one has gone before, says Andy. And I want my ashes put out on the Curragh Plains, my favourite place in the world. And before I'm cremated, I'm going to the Royal College of Surgeons for trainee doctors to practice on. Afterwards, my ashes are going to be scattered on water, says Linda. So you're donating your body to science. Maybe I'll do that as well, by the way. There's no use to me when I'm dead. When all this is over, says Katrina, yourself and your team are welcome anytime on board the Bandwagon Bus. It's a tour of Dublin with a full band on board, belting out the songs of Dublin with a huge amount of crack thrown in. We were all set to launch, but COVID had other ideas. Thanks for that invitation. The Bandwagon Bus sounds like something we might do. Was only discussing this at the weekend. On a funny note, I will get ashes made into egg timers. Ah, there's an idea. If you prefer your poached egg a little harder, you'll get a slightly bigger timer. Alternatively, scattered in the Circle of Life, which is the organ donor garden in Salt Hill. Beautiful place to visit and reflect, says Mary. If I get cremated, I'll have my ashes encased in the jet black violin I bought online after a few pints during lockdown. As it's probably the only time it'll ever be taken out of its case, is Cormac. I don't know if you're just combining two things we were talking about and making it up, but that's good. Yeah, I'm gonna learn the violin. Well, I have to buy it. I sure can't learn the violin if I don't have one. So there you go. PayPal, one click, Amazon, gone. Before you know it, there's a man knocking at your door. Sign for this. I didn't buy that. Oh, yes, you did. Black violin. That's funny. 51551RadioRT.ie. I have to tell you about our quiz of today. Today, 24th of March. And we've cobbled together 10 questions on things that happened on this day over the years. You know, the big news stories, scientific breakthroughs, movies, TV shows, songs, births and deaths. And we're looking for two people to answer five questions each. And our prize today comes courtesy of Electric Ireland, who want to help us all be smarter about how we manage our energy usage. And with the launch of their smart meter price plans, they're going to help us do just that. And you can search Electric Ireland smart meters to find out more. And thanks to Electric Ireland, the person who wins our quiz of today will win a brand new 50-inch HD smart TV. That's nice, isn't it? Yeah. But first, you have to answer our qualifying question, which is this. In which Irish county would you find the town of Bandon? In which Irish county would you find the town of Bandon? 1850 715 900. That's 1850 715 900. Two people after 4 o'clock. Could be you, and you could win for yourself a 50-inch HD smart TV. Good luck with that.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Dermot's been on to 51551 from Detroit. He says, greetings. About your point on ashes and bullets and Lemmy, a friend of mine passed a couple of years back. His family had him cremated and his teenage daughter had a little bit of his ashes mixed into tattoo ink. She has a little symbol on her arm now forever that contains a little bit of her dad. That's sort of very nice, isn't it? That's lovely. Constant reminder of her dad who's passed away. Or died, as they say. Now, you've probably seen the pictures. There's a huge container ship blocking the Suez Canal. Yeah. Tugboats and diggers are working to free the giant ship as we speak. Officials say it veered off course in a sandstorm, creating huge tailbacks on one of the world's busiest trade routes. Well, we wanted to chat to someone who has travelled the canal, so I'm joined now by Irishman Benjamin Hopkins, navigation officer with Princess Cruises. How are you, Benjamin?
Hiya, Ray. How's it going?
Are you a Benjamin or a Ben?
I'm a Ben, actually. You're Only Ben. My parents call me Benjamin when I've done something naughty.
Yes, yeah. So a navigation officer. So you're up there on deck, are you, in the big cruise ships?
Well, that's correct, yeah. We'd be up on the bridge of the cruise ship. So, yeah, I work with most of the Princess Cruise fleet. And we just do navigational watches on board, just maintaining navigational safety of the vessel while transiting.
Okay, when you woke up this morning and you saw this is one of the biggest stories going because of the picture, I suppose. So it's 400 metres long, 59 metres wide. The canal itself is only about what? What's the width of the canal?
The width of the canal, it's not much more than the width of the vessel. It's a very, very narrow canal. It's only about 120 miles long.
Right.
And it's only about under 80 metres wide. So it's not much, and then it's shallow at the edges. So you got to be careful. It's a very, very tight piece of navigational water.
Right, 120 miles long. I was reading there today that 12% of world trade go through the Suez Canal. Like it's hugely important when it comes to the world's economy, isn't it, Ben?
It's massively important. So as you know, like a lot of goods, even in Ireland and all over Europe, come by sea. Possibly 90% of all of our white goods and all goods that we consume come in, and it really works off a hub and spoke kind of system from Rotterdam. So these big heavy vessels coming from China. And they've two options when they're coming from China. They can go through the Suez Canal, saving themselves about 1,900 miles by not going down around the coast of Africa and around the Cape of Good Hope. So that's where the Suez Canal really comes into its own. It's a huge distance saving and fuel saving to get goods from, say, China to Europe.
So this ship will be carrying high-end goods from China to Rotterdam, and then they'd be distributed all over Europe, some of them probably coming to Ireland.
Well, I'm not sure how high-end the goods from China are now, but definitely they're bringing in goods.
Well, the iPhones are made in China. You know, a lot of high-end goods are made in China.
True.
So how long does it take to get from one end of the canal to the other?
So to transit the canal, it really depends on the speed of the vessel and the restrictions. But it generally takes 13 to 14 hours to get through the canal, depending on the size of the vessel.
Right.
And you see, you have a thing called a Suez Canal pilot, and he will board the vessel before you enter the canal. And he'll basically dictate to the ship what speed is safe for the prevailing circumstances and conditions. So as you were alluding to earlier about the sandstorm, he would have should have taken that into consideration while transiting the canal.
Right. So this is ginormous. I think the last time it was blocked was during World War II when it was done on purpose. So this is going to cause a big back jam. Or backlog, yeah. I should say.
It's a massive backlog. Yeah, it's like the M50. There's about 64 ships sitting on one side and about 15 on the other side. And they're all bottlenecking up at the canal, basically trying to figure out what they're going to do. And it kind of leaves vessel managers with kind of two options. They either sit it out and wait for the canal to be unblocked, or they choose to go around the capes. And as I said earlier, that's another 1,900 miles that those vessels have to travel.
Yeah, how can they possibly do this? I know you're not an expert, but what would you think? How can they fix it?
How can they fix it? Well, they're in the process, I believe. I only know what's on the media at the moment. Yeah. There will be an accident investigation and everything else. But from what we can see on the media, there is two tugs there at the moment down from Dubai who are still trying to pull the vessel off the banks. So basically it's smaller little vessels. They're tractor tugs. They're very powerful and they basically can swig off the side of the vessel to try and pull it back into the channel so it can regain itself and travel on its journey.
Yeah. Just 400 metres long and 59 metres wide. That's a colossal vessel, isn't it? It's like ginormous.
She's quite big, yeah. She's about 20,000 TEU.
What's that now? What's that then?
Yeah, so that's ton equivalent units. So it's based on a 20-foot container. So she can fit about 20,000 of those 20-foot containers in her holds and on her deck. So she's a rather large container vessel on her way to Rotterdam to then be disembark all her cargo there, and then it'll go on hub and spoke to places like Ireland, England, and onto trains all over Europe.
So and if they removed a couple of thousand of those containers and lighten a load, would that help?
I'd say it would help a bit, yeah, because it would decrease her draft a bit. But the whole thing as well of unloading containers, unloading cargo, you have to have the cranes in place and everything in place to do that.
Yes, yeah.
And there's qualified salvage experts who would be involved in this, and they'd be trying to figure out the best way and the most economic way and quickest way to get the ship back on its way. Because as you said yourself, it's 12% of world trade. They kind of need to get it back open ASAP.
Okay. And when will you be back in business? The cruise business was shut down pretty swiftly, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Well, I've been on shore leave now for 12 months from Princess Cruise Line. So, but they're waiting and hoping, just like everyone else with this COVID-19, to see what happens. And hopefully there will be a resolution soon. But their fleet's all there on standby. They're ready to go whenever this all clears up.
A vaccine passport would work for cruises, I would imagine, wouldn't it?
I wouldn't really know too much about
imagine
that.
Imagine if everybody, you could only book your cruise if you had your vaccine passport up to date, you know, that you'd got vaccinated. It might work,
It could be a logical thing to do, but the only thing is there's issues with that as well. Some people maybe for health reasons can't take vaccines, and then you're precluding them for doing cruises. So there's with every decision, there's always a flip side on it.
Okay, imagine this. We've two texts in on the Suez Canal. Simon here in Wicklow, true story. My dad nearly blew up the Suez Canal. He was steering a ship through it. Wrecked tired, was foggy, was meeting a ship but couldn't see it. The captain came on the bridge, spotted the other ship, shouted hard, starboard, and they skimmed each other. Two oil tankers. Close call. So when two ships hit off each other, that's a collision. And what we witnessed in those pictures, what's that called?
That's an olision. So it's collided with the land. Olision. A non-moving object. Yeah, an olision.
Olision, right. That's a new one on me. Olision. That's my word of the day now. me and my wife were very lucky to be working on board the QE2 cruise liner. When I went through the Suez Canal, it was extremely tight with little gap each side. But that's a once-in-a-lifetime thing, isn't it? So, Ben, thanks for sharing your experience with us today. And mind yourself, and I hope you get back to work ASAP.
Hopefully. Thank you very much, Ray.
Thanks, Ben. Bye, bye, bye.
Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Last September, we spoke to Dr. Claire Dunn from Lesbos. She was a doctor working in the Moria refugee camp. And there had been a bit of a disaster there, a crisis when the refugee camp went on fire. She's back working in Ireland now, and she's along with other teachers and doctors and other people who've worked in volunteer capacities around the world, have launched the 400 Welcome campaign. And Claire is on the line to tell us about it. How are you doing, Claire?
Hi, Ray. Thanks for having me.
Good to talk to you again. I don't know if you saw the cover of the Irish Times today.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, that must have brought back memories to you. It's a picture of a burnt out refugee camp from Bangladesh. The Rohingyas had left Myanmar, and they were occupying these refugee camps in Bangladesh, and the whole thing went on fire. 15 people dead, 400 people missing. Similar to what happened in Moria back in September of last year.
Absolutely, yes.
We've no idea, really, you know, from what goes on in these places. And well, you do, obviously, but most of us don't. It's horrific, isn't it, the living conditions in these refugee camps around the world?
Well, that's the thing. I suppose, you know, since I've come back, sometimes when I've been talking to people about my experiences there, you know, they say things like, well, you know, at least they're safe now that they're in Greece. But the reality is these camps on the Greek islands aren't safe. And, you know, since February, there have been 5 fires in the new camp that's been created on the island. And we know that the soil in this new camp is in parts contaminated with high levels, dangerous levels of lead. And we've all probably all seen pictures of the frequent flooding, of tents collapsing.
Yeah, we've lost Claire. We lost her for good. Try and get her back up there. Of course, a few years ago, more than 5 years ago, we were constantly seeing the pictures of people leaving the coast of Turkey, trying to get to the Greek islands. And there were some iconic pictures of the child on the beach and, you know, 20 or 30 people in an inflated dinghy trying to get across that stretch of the Mediterranean Sea, and sometimes succeeding and sometimes failing. And I suppose it's gone off the front pages. So it's important that we talk to people like Claire. Can we get Claire back up? Or hello, Claire.
I think I'm here.
You're there now. Yes, you're there.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. I don't know when I dropped, so I don't know where.
About a minute ago, if you can calculate
okay.
That. No, I was just saying to people that you know, 5 years ago or so, we were seeing all those images of people trying to get from Turkey to the Greek islands, and then something happened 5 years ago. The EU made an arrangement with Turkey, and I suppose those. The pictures went off the front pages, so we need to remind people of what's ongoing in these camps in on the Greek islands. So you were saying about the new camp and the soil.
Yeah, so I mean, and absolutely. So just when you were saying there about 5 years ago, and so what's happened is people are now being contained in these very inhumane camps and severely substandard living conditions where their basic human needs aren't being met. And that has been happening for the past 5 years. And over the past 5 years, we've seen time after time the profound physical and psychological impacts of these camps on people's health. And, you know, regardless of the terrible conditions in the camp, you know, not only just the squalid living conditions, but also the completely inadequate protection of vulnerable groups, the shameful lack of access to legal aid and advice and support in terms of the asylum process, and, you know, just general poor treatment of people in the camp. Tens of thousands of people have still made the journey across, you know, hostile borders, experiencing often, you know, police brutality at these borders and violence, dangerous seas, putting their lives and their kids' lives at risk. And they're doing this because they're facing impossible choices. They're fleeing what they perceive to be much worse than the conditions in these camps.
But of course, the conditions
in these camps are terrible, and they're unnecessarily terrible. And it's you know, a creation, essentially, a policy. It doesn't have to be this way. And that's part of the reason why we're calling for, you know, the evacuation or the relocation of at least some of these people to Ireland in solidarity with the experiences that people have had. Yeah.
Now, when we saw the pictures from the camp last September, the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, went on Twitter and said, we will have 50 of those people, which seems like a very small number. But anyway, that's what she said at the time. Where is that at?
So those 50 have not arrived to Ireland yet. And, you know, as I indicated, every single day people are at risk in these camps, at risk of fire, at risk of flooding, at risk of many other dangers, and also completely inadequate access to healthcare support. A lot of mental health impacts because the camps are progressing more and more to locked and closed camps now as well, so lack of freedom. So the people are still in the camp, and we're calling for 50 people to come urgently to Ireland, as was committed by the government. And we know that the procedures and the structures are in place for that. But we're also calling for an expansion beyond the 50 to at least 400 people, which we feel is a very reasonable and doable number.
OK. We got on to the Department of Justice and we got a response. The Irish government has agreed to welcome 50 people in family groups from Greece following the tragedy at the Moria camp. Irish officials from DCEDIY have worked with Greek authorities to select families. Arrangements are being made for the transfer of refugees following the necessary security checks. This will be done as soon as personnel are in a position to travel to Greece to carry out these checks. So that's how do you feel about that? That seems to answer it.
Well, I suppose I would just, you know, like to emphasise again the urgency of this, and that, yes, as you said, you know, we're not seeing as much in the media what's happening, and, you know, more and more journalists are not being allowed into these camps. NGOs and medics are not allowed to speak about what they see in the camp by law now, in terms of abuse and neglect. So, you know, just to kind of really emphasise that this is urgent, that people's health has been severely severely impacted,
There, will you just talk to us a bit about that then? Who has clamped down on journalists and people like you speaking?
Well, I suppose the Greek authorities. It was a Greek law that was enacted in December 2020 saying that no volunteers, NGO personnel or people operating within the camp can speak to what they see or hear within the camp. It was already a rule that was being enforced more or less even prior to the law, in that, you know, if a police person or if someone in a position of authority saw you taking a picture or a video in the camp, then, you know, you would be removed from the camp as a volunteer or as a medic. But now it's enacted in law. And then I suppose in terms of the journalism piece, the excuse at the moment is COVID. But, you know, I would question that. That it's, you know, making things more invisible and what's happening in the camp, which is truly appalling, really more invisible to people.
So you want the 50 that have been promised and 350 others to be invited to Ireland, to be welcomed to Ireland.
Yeah. To be welcomed to Ireland, exactly. And I suppose just to speak about the people in the camp, you know, so there's people of all ages, newborns to older people from a variety of backgrounds, lots of different skills and energies, and I think that people have already shown great bravery and strength in making it as far as Europe. And I've met some amazing people who I think would be an asset to Europe or any community. But unfortunately, they're being contained in these conditions that are making them sick. So, yes, we're calling on the Irish government to show humane leadership on this issue and to welcome 400 people who are in this camp to Ireland and to Irish communities. And we had a massive response to the 400 Welcomes campaign that you alluded to in September. And I think that just shows that the will is there, that the people, you know, in many communities across Ireland want to support and stand in solidarity with those who are fleeing war and persecution. Yes, so if people wanted to get involved, they could follow us on Twitter or Instagram. And we have a petition going at the moment that I would encourage everybody to sign. Again, just putting pressure on government and asking TDs to ask the relevant questions about getting more people out of this camp.
Is it difficult to get people motivated? I know you said that you did have offers of people who were willing to put refugees into their own homes, etc. But because it's at a distance from us and people would claim we have our own problems here and the pandemic, etc., do you find that people just don't want to hear about it?
Well, I suppose, firstly, you know, it wasn't... We had a big response in September, and yes, some of it was in relation to offers of bringing people into their own homes. But just to clarify that these people will be coming through an already existing program that's in place. I mean, when I speak to people about the stories of people within the camp and I suppose the reality of the situation with the camp, in the camp, I actually don't think it's that hard to get people interested or motivated. Right. But I think because they're not maybe seeing it so much in the media here until maybe they meet someone who's been there or have had the experiences, it's not as easy to connect.
And how are you settling back? You know, you're back working as a GP. Have you got itchy feet now? Do you think you'll do more voluntary work or what will happen?
You know, I'm happy to be here for now, for sure, and I'm happy to be working in general practice. But I do see myself going back to Lesbos or similar settings in the future, for sure.
Okay. And what people can do to help is to bring this up with their local politicians.
Exactly. And to sign the petition that we have going that's available on Twitter and on Instagram. the 400 Welcomes Uplift petition, and also, yes, to bring it to the attention of local government, government ministers,
Dr. Claire Dunn, thanks so much for taking time out to talk to us today. Thanks, Claire.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Tweet at Radio Ray RTE. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Five on 551 for your text. Bought a guitar during the first lockdown with every intention of being a master after a few months. Before I started practicing, my friend was tightening the strings on the couch and broke one. It's behind the couch since gathering dust. you're not the only one. I'd say, you know, I said I was going to learn how to play the piano. And then we have a violin, the guitar, numerous things people bought with good intentions, but then the motivation went. Now, when first we spoke to Derek Cawley, spinal surgeon from the Mater Hospital last month, we were inundated with questions from listeners and we didn't get time to get to them. So we said we'd have Derek back on, and we're people of our word. So good afternoon, Derek Cawley.
Hi, Ray. How are you doing?
Not too bad. There's a little bit of a gap there, but we'll see how we go with it. So just to remind people about working from home and what you told us last time you were on, it's all about moving.
Hey, that's right. So the survey that we did showed that a lot of people are presenting with neck pain, back pain, and a lot of it is due to the fact that they're sitting down all day, they're not exercising and they're not stretching. So, for example, where previously we had a commute or the stairs or the water cooler or the photocopier or whatever we did during work, now a significant proportion of people are working from home and they are...
They're not moving around.
Correct. Particularly the hip joints, the hip muscles, because therefore they're straining their back then when they do move. So I see a lot of that, particularly then when those people try to go walking or running. And I suppose running is something that I guess a significant number of people enjoy running. I do see patients with low back pain when trying to run, particularly after a period of inactivity, and why that can happen. You know, that's something that's very important. Especially where they're trying to get in shape after not running for a while and perhaps their hip muscles are a little bit weak and stiff.
I do my stretch exercises after running. You'll be glad to hear, Derek.
I'm glad to hear that, Ray. That's good.
It's boring as hell. We discussed this the last time. Stretching is boring, but you know you have to do it. And I suppose the older you get, the more important it is. So I do it. It's not something I look forward to, but I do it every morning. And it's paid off because the hips are great. There's no creakiness or pain or anything, so it's obviously working. Now you were watching Operation Transformation, and something you want to draw to our attention is about back pain. Go on.
That's right. And the prevalence of low back pain in the obese population is significantly higher than the non-obese population. So up to 30% of people carrying extra weight at any one time are experiencing low back pain, Ray. And the first thing I would say is that while carrying excess weight is a significant risk factor for low back pain, that doesn't necessarily mean that the first thing you do is tell that person to lose weight, because that's very hard. It's very difficult to try and lose weight in the presence of low back pain. So I guess as a society, we have to be kinder to these people and recognize what they're going through in terms of emotionally and physically and in terms of the pain experience that they may have. So it's all about getting a system going of pain-free exercises and recognizing why it causes pain. So obviously, if you're carrying extra weight, the joints, the discs, etc., they're all doing a harder job and therefore more likely to experience pain. So there's a biomechanical part, and then there's the newer science in this stuff also. There's the biochemical stuff that we don't really understand, and it's basically where the higher amount of fat cells contain more pro-inflammatory hormones. So the body's in more of a, we'll say, experiences more pain because there's more inflammation in the system, you know?
Wow, I've never heard that before.
If you look at these guys, yeah, absolutely. It's a fascinating new area looking at the hormones from the fat cells can do. It's not just about a case of carrying extra weight and the biomechanical effects. It's the biochemical. But also, Ray, if you look at people like Brian O'Driscoll or Tony McCoy or any of our, we'll say, elite athletes whose joints are probably in bits, they have very low levels of pain because of the fact that they've had a high level of exercise for most of their lives. And therefore, exercise is a very good way of counteracting the pro-inflammatory problems from obesity. So exercise, therefore, has an anti-inflammatory effect on the body because it excretes a higher level of cortisol that dampens down that pain response.
Okay, so what do people do then if they want to lose weight and they're experiencing lower back pain and you don't suggest they run? What do they do? What's the ideal exercise for them?
Right, so first of all, the stretches on the ground. Start on the ground in terms of stretches and in terms of bridging the pelvis. So by that I mean lifting the pelvis off the ground and holding it. Mm. And the way I do it, Ray, is I split it into two. You got your stretches and you got your strengthening exercises. And it's going to be a combination of both. And the key thing is to start in a place of comfort. Okay, so that's the first thing. And obviously, looking for exercises, anybody can download it from the web. But in order to get proper supervision, they would benefit from attending a physiotherapist or some sports therapist, etc., to kind of help them along the way with that.
Okay.
In terms of an exercise, it's hard to tell a person go out walking or running because oftentimes that's when their pain gets worse. And I would always recommend the exercise bike for a person like that. Now, it's very important to recognize there's two types of exercise bike, Ray, and we're very familiar with the one with the saddle, and that's not the one for someone with a bad back. Okay. The exercise bike for a person with low back pain, with obesity in particular, is the recumbent one. It's the one with the chair and the handles on either sides of the chair. So in a lot of gyms, not that we go to them anymore, of course, but what happens is you'll see two different types of bikes. And if you've got one with a saddle and you're carrying extra weight and you want to do that a little bit more, I'd say put it on Dundee or something like that and buy the one with the chair instead.
Right, okay. Good advice. Just before we get to our listeners' queries, just while we have you on, Tiger Woods and his back. That's an ongoing problem for him. What do you know as an expert? Are you interested in Tiger Woods' back at all?
So, Ray, I think this is a really good story to illustrate what the actual disc does for any of our backs. Okay, so the disc is commonly known as a shock absorber in the back. Okay, but it does a much more important job than that as well. It acts as what's known as an energy converter. So it allows us to rotate our spine. And if you think of the spine as a chain, okay. And you can wind up that chain, and no better way to express the power and the torque of unwinding that spring or unwinding that coil than the way Tiger can drive a ball. Okay, so you rotate the spine around in a backswing, the farther and better you can counter rotate, you can drive the ball farther. So the disc acts. Exactly. So the disc actually, the fibers in the disc are pointed in such a way that you can use them all together as a spring that you can wind up and unwind to unleash that energy. And the problem is, of course, that you push that too far and you're going to bust one of those discs. And that's what he did at the bottom of his back. And we all know that he had major spine surgery and he returned to winning the Masters in 2017, was it? But what he had done, he had a couple of discectomies, which, you know, kind of kept him there or thereabouts. But ultimately, he needed a spinal fusion. And the procedure he had done was where they fused him through the abdomen. It went in through the front of his tummy and fused the spine from the front. Now, I like this procedure a lot because patients experience that they've less pain after the surgery. They've less muscle dissection. And it's really good for correcting their posture. So the anterior lumbar fusion is a really good one to do. And he did well from that. But of course, the problem was that then he wore out the level above it. And then, of course, he crashed his car and the rest is history.
Is he gone for good now, do you think?
Well, knowing Tiger, I'd say he's the kind of guy who has the mental strength to still demonstrate to himself that he can return. Yeah. So it wouldn't surprise me. Now, while he should cash in and relax and enjoy life like anybody, I suspect he'll be back.
He's unlikely to do that. Now, Derek, every time I hoover the house, I get bad lower back pain the next day. It lasts for 2 to 3 days, but then goes. What can I do to stop this?
Right. Well, I guess the activity of hoovering the house What is the likely cause? The likely cause is that they have irritated the joints in the bottom of the back, Ray.
Right.
And there's a bit too much, lifting outside of their comfort zone. And the best way to deal with that is to stretch it out. The anti-inflammatories are the only medication proven to help in that case. And to use non-medical measures, massage, rollerball, hot water bottle, a glass of red wine, 2 weeks in Lanzarote, whatever helps to just ease that back.
Right. Could you ask the doctor, what's the best thing for lower back pain due to bulging discs on a nerve?
Great. Ellen wants to know. Great question. Yeah, absolutely. So the key thing, first of all, is it's like grey hair and wrinkles. That doesn't necessarily mean that there is a problem in the back. And a bulging disc is only relevant if there is associated leg pain. Because if you've got if you've got bad leg pain, or what's known as sciatica, that means that bulge is causing nerve compression. Okay, so if it's not causing leg pain and nerve compression, then it doesn't matter if you've got a bulging disc in your lower back. And you could apply the same principle to the neck and arm pain.
Right, okay. But how do you fix it? You just let it go, dear.
Well, how do you fix grey hair and wrinkles? I mean, you as long as you're alive and healthy and walking and relatively pain-free, then you're not doing too bad.
I like your style. I like your attitude. Okay, I have a pain in my lower back which comes and goes over the course of a week. When should I go to see my GP about back pain? How long should I wait? Hugh wants
to know. So when they say over the course of a week, that the natural history, i.e. if it's left untreated, that will settle down. And it's good to coordinate the GP in terms of awareness, in terms of going through any symptoms that might be worrisome, and coordinate treatment with a therapist such as a physiotherapist, manual therapist, etc. Yeah. And work on posture, work on alignment, work on movement. Typically, they say that up to 25% of people have pain that goes on for more than 3 months, okay? So we used to call it chronic low back pain. It's now more politically correct to call it persistent low back pain.
Right.
And that's outside of the natural history.
Chronic? Why can't you use the word chronic?
I think because, the Irish person uses chronic as in it's terrible, as
yes.
opposed to going on for a long time. Whereas yes. the British, I think, have kind of updated their guidelines on this, and they just want to call it something that's less toxic. I think that's where
persistent.
It's coming from.
So, right, it's persistent as opposed to chronic.
Exactly. That's it.
You learn something new every day.
There you go.
Poor chronic. Poor chronic has been elbowed out of our vocabulary.
But anyway, that person should probably seek the advice of a physio or a GP and get an exercise program and medical and non-medical measures.
Stretchercise. I'm going to launch a website called stretchercise.ie.
Absolutely. Stretches are great.
You and me, Derek, we can do it together. Put up videos.
Yeah, I'm all over it.
Thanks, Derek. Thanks very much. That's
all
Derek
right,
Cawley there, spine surgeon at the Mater Private Hospital. We will have Derek on again. Anishtosh and now the Freef Skelton and Oakta Le Cotta Wallish. Gurmaga Cot, thanks very much. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Here we go here. It's time for our quiz of today. Today being the 24th of March. And we have 10 questions on events that happened on this day over the years and the decades and the centuries. And our prize today comes courtesy of Electric Ireland. They want us to tell you about their smart meters. If you search Electric Ireland smart meters, you can find out more. And thanks to our friends at Electric Ireland, the person who wins today will get for themselves a 50-inch HD smart TV. Let's go. Hello, Neil Comiskey.
Hello, Ray.
Is it Comiskey or Comiskey?
Well, it depends where you are in the country. Over in the west, people say Comiskey, but I'm originally from Dundalk, and we would pronounce it Comiskey over that direction.
Aha, aha. Comiskey, Comiskey. Yeah. There was Comiskeys in Kildare. They used to say Comiskey as opposed to Comiskey.
Well, yes, right.
Yeah, yeah. So what brought you from Louth to Leitrim?
Well, my wife is from Roscommon, and we were living in Dundalk, and I got a job. I used to work in air, and I took redundancy from it there about 3 years ago, but we came down here. I got a job working in Longford 20 years ago. So
right.
That's how we landed. We picked Drummond. And that's how we ended up over here.
I spoke to somebody from Drummond recently. It's a lovely part of the world on the Shannon there.
You did. You spoke to my next door neighbour, in fact, not too long ago.
how did they do?
He got bogged down. I think the only problem was everything was going well until the population of Poland was asked or something like that.
So you've been studying up your populations, have you, Neil? So the lockdown is, it's dreary and dragging on, you say. That's, and I think
it's a little bit like that.
Yeah,
I try to be positive, but sure, we live in hope and be hopeful. Something'll turn up.
I think we have to allow ourselves to have down days. You know what I mean? Yeah, because if you keep fighting it too much and you try to put on that positive face too much, it's wearing. It gets very tiring.
Yeah. I suppose you're being honest. We have to be honest with ourselves. At the same time, it's right. You're dead right there. Right?
And is it Marie or Mary? We're on all
well,
on the punch.
Mary. I can be mixed up with Neil and Niall many a time. And Mary and Marie. Our daughter is Maria as well. That adds to the confusion. But it's great.
Right. And what does Marie do? Mary do?
She's a special needs assistant in the local school, School Mura in Barnacoola.
So she's back to work.
She's back. Yeah, back in action. Yeah.
Yeah, and she probably is. Loving that, I'd say.
Yeah, she really, it was great. She was delighted to be getting back. Yeah, absolutely.
You're up against David Doyle. No problem with pronunciation there. And Carla, how are you doing, David?
How are you, Mr. Darcy? How are you?
Good to talk to you. You're in your early 50s, it says here.
Never give away your age. You never know who could be listening.
How are the 50s for you? How are you finding them?
It's like being in your early 30s.
Yeah.
Getting younger as it goes along.
Yeah, I see you're running away anyway. You're doing 40k a week. That's a good old...
Be a runner, yeah. 40k some weeks, and then other weeks it could be less than that.
Yeah.
So, but my other half would call me a jogger, not a runner. God bless her.
Yeah, but because it used to be jogging, wasn't it? And then we're all runners now. We're not really runners.
We're all runners now.
Yeah.
We're all runners.
Yeah. I saw a quote over the weekend from what's her name, Victoria Wood. She's a comedian, actor, woman,
yes.
And she says people who run aren't intelligent enough to appreciate morning television. That's why they run. That's what she said. So while everybody else is sitting down watching morning television, we're out running. So there you go.
We're out running. Yes, catching the early rise.
So you've two children. What age?
Dylan and Emma.
Right.
My son is just about to turn 17, and my daughter is 12, a soccer player and a princess.
Right.
God bless them.
And is your son leaving cert or fifth year?
Fifth year.
Radio.
Yeah.
Right. Now, lads, we have a telly to give away. 10 questions. Whoever answers most of the 5 questions each correctly gets the prize. If it's a draw, we go to a tie-break situation. David, if you say good luck to Neil.
Good luck, Neil. Or Niall.
Good luck, David.
Or David. Right, here we go. Right, Neil, first question for you. On this day in 1924, Greece became a republic. What are the two colours on the flag of Greece? Red and white or blue and white?
Red and white or blue and white. Greece. I go blue and white.
Is the correct answer. Yeah, same colours as Waterford. On this day in 1970, David Judith Draxler, champion Austrian swimmer, was born in Vienna. What are the two colours on the Austrian flag? Black and white or red and white?
Austria. I'll go black and white.
No, it's red and white. It's red and white. Okay. Early days. Neil, second question for you is an audio one. Have a listen to this.
I am out here for you. You don't know what it's like to be me out here for you. It is an up at dawn, pride swallowing siege that I will never fully tell you about, okay?
On this day in 1997, at the 69th Academy Awards, that actor you heard was nominated for a Best Actor Award for his role in Jerry Maguire. Can you name him?
Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise, correct answer. Right, David, we need you here. It's an audio one. Have a listen to this.
Our whole universe was in a hot, dense state that nearly 14 billion years ago expansion started. Wait. The Earth began to cool. The autotrophs began to drool. Neanderthals developed tools. We built a wall. We built a
pyramid. On this day in 1973, Jim Parsons, who plays the part of Sheldon Cooper in that sitcom, was born in Houston, Texas. Can you name the sitcom?
Big Bang Theory.
It's the correct answer. You're on the scoreboard. Great stuff.
Hey.
Neil, question number 3 for you. On this day in 1815, the Handel and Haydn Musical Society of Boston was founded. In which US state would you find the city of Boston?
Massachusetts.
Correct answer. For you, David, on this day in 1883, the first telephone call between New York and Chicago took place. In which US state would you find the city of Chicago?
Oh.
need an answer from you.
I'll go with no, I've lost it. No answer.
No, nothing. No. Nothing there. No. Illinois. See, we all know Massachusetts because it's Boston. is a destination for Irish people. Anyway, so Neil's on three, David, you're on one. You have to hope that, David goes pear-shaped on us here for you to be in with a chance. Neil, have a listen to this. So Neil, this one's for the telly. If you get it right, David can't catch it. On this day in 2009, that song was number one. Can you name the singer? No.
Yeah. I'll take a chance and say Madonna.
You see, this girl was accused of being a Madonna-like, if you know what I mean. Lady Gaga.
Yes.
Right,
yes.
Chink of light for you, David. So have a listen to this.
Never mind, I'll find someone like you.
There you go. On this day in 2011, that song was number one. Can you name the singer?
Is it Adele?
It is Adele. Two plays three. Right. Neil, again, get this right and the telly's yours, get it wrong. And if David gets his final question correct, we're into a tie-break situation. Good luck with this. Neil, on this day in 1937, Italy and Yugoslavia signed a non-aggression treaty. Which of these countries has a larger population than Italy? Is it the United Kingdom, South Africa, or South Korea? So which has a larger population than Italy? The UK, South Africa, or South Korea?
South Africa.
Italy has a population of 60 million. South Africa, 59 million. South Korea, 51 million. The UK, 67 million.
You're right.
It's the populations and the Drummond population don't match. Okay, David.
No pressure.
Get this right, and we're into a tiebreak situation. Good luck. On this day in 1992, the first person from Belgium to go into space, Dirk Vrimoot, launched on the Atlanta space shuttle. Which of these countries has a larger population than Belgium? Hungary, the Netherlands, or Austria? So which of those has a larger population than Belgium? Hungary, the Netherlands, or Austria?
I'll go Hungary.
You're going Hungary. Belgium has a population of 11 million. Hungary has a population of 9 million. The Netherlands we were looking for with 17 million.
Oh well,
it's right. Oh well. Could have been. Okay.
Well, could have been.
David, we're going to send you out a Ray Darcy Show mug. Great talking to you. Mind yourself.
Super.
Keep running.
Thank you very much.
And don't forget to do the stretching.
I'll do my best.
See you, David. Bye.
Thank you.
Well, Neil, you've booked the trend for Drummond people. You didn't get the population answer correct, but you got yourself a 50-inch HD smart television from Electric
Brilliant.
Ireland.
Fantastic, Ray. Thanks
Great.
Very much.
Well done. Good talking
Thank
to you.
You.
See you
Thanks
now. See you, Neil. Bye.
All
Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or text 51551. Catherine has been on. Would you tell me the name of the exercise bike Derek recommended? A recumbent. Recumbent. Isn't that a lovely word? Recumbent bike is what you're looking for. So it has a seat as opposed to a saddle. So it supports your lower back. And he recommended that for people who are carrying a bit of weight if they're going into the gym to exercise. And yeah, somebody points out that sadly Victoria Wood passed away in 2016. It was a quote in an article by somebody else. And he was slagging off the whole jogging thing and he quoted her in the article. Now, we have to speak to a man who's going to sail around the planet without any technological navigational equipment. His name is Peter Lawless and we'll speak to him after this. Diddly-bop-bam-bam. Mary Black and Carolina Rue on RTE Radio 1. 5 on 5 on ray@rte.ie. Peter Lawless is in the middle of planning a very unique trip. In August, he intends on sailing solo, non-stop, unassisted around the world from Ireland back to Ireland via the Five Great Capes. And Peter joins us on the line. How you doing, Peter?
Hiya, Ray. How's things?
Good. You a bit mad?
You definitely. You'd have to be.
You'd have to be. Yeah. What I didn't mention there in that intro is that you're not going to hit land at all.
No, it's a non-stop circumnavigation, yeah.
Right. And no, you're not using any technology as such?
Well, I'll have all the modern equipment on board, but I decided to use the sextant for navigation, celestial navigation, you know, paper charts.
Yeah.
As a primary navigation, I will have all the electrical equipment on board, and I'll have all the safety gear as well, you know.
But only in case of emergency, is that it?
In case of emergency, or if I had to turn it on, yeah.
I mean,
that was just a personal thing I wanted to do. I did a Yachtmaster course, and part of that was learning the sextant, and I really liked it. So, and there's something very satisfying about looking at charts and seeing your position as opposed to a screen, you know.
Yeah. You've been sailing all your life. Can you remember the first time you were in a boat?
I can, actually. I was only talking to my sister about this the other day. My sister Helen is 4 or 5 years older than me, and she remembers it too. My dad put me into there's a small dinghy called an Optimist. People would know that, the listeners would know. But my dad put me into that. I remember getting into it, and he pushed me out. And I was nervous. I was four. So that was my first time going on my own in a boat. It was in a sheltered harbour in Mount Shannon in County Clare.
Yeah.
But... and I loved it. I really loved it. My sister said she was nervous, you know. But
and you've been sailing ever since.
My earliest memory. But yeah, we all grew up in the boats with my dad. Yeah, and my mum. Yeah, my mum used to mind us all, and you know.
Yeah,
and the dog.
You're sort of emulating your dad in this trip. What did he do back in 1996?
In 1996, he sailed back into Kilrush, where I'd be leaving from, actually, Kilrush Marine and Clare. Huh? He sailed back in there after 3 years. Circumnavigation on his own in a 30-foot. Yeah.
And what are you in?
I'm sailing a Rival 41. For any of the listeners that like boats, it's a Rival 41, a beautiful boat that was built for offshore sailing. They're very heavily constructed, and it's a beautiful boat. It's a lovely boat. Perfect for it.
And have you had to sort of refashion it for your trip?
Oh, God, yeah. I have it out of the water. I've been working on it for quite a while for this, but she's out of the water in a boatyard in Kilrush, actually, getting all the rigging and the mast replaced, new sails. Oh, it's endless, Ray. It's a big undertaking. And it has to be perfect. Everything has to be new. And you'd want a backup of everything as well, if possible, if something goes wrong. There's nowhere to pull in and get a guy in to fix it. You know, you'd want to be fairly self-sufficient for that length of time.
And that's the thing, the self-sufficiency of it all. And I know you've been sailing for, you know, the best part of 5 decades. But does this thing you're taking on, does it not scare you a little bit?
It would. I mean, you'd be foolish if you weren't nervous. I'd have a very healthy respect for the ocean and for nature, you know. So you'd have to be nervous, but the benefit or the good days would definitely outweigh the days where you'd be having the stormy days, you know. So, I mean, I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, I don't think you should do it if you weren't looking forward.
No,
to,
I suppose.
If you,
yeah, but yeah, sometimes
I know what to expect most of the time. I think, you know.
Yeah, but sometimes as humans we say things out loud and then we're committed to them, and then, you know, we go, "Oh, Jane, I shouldn't have said that." Anyway, what's your route? So you're leaving from Kilrush sometime in August, and you head south, obviously.
I head south, yeah, down past the Canaries, the Cape Verdes, down under the bottom of South Africa, head east then for Australia, New Zealand, and keep going on under the famous Cape Horn. Hopefully January, February, it's a good time there. It's kind of the summer season there, so hopefully the weather would be as good as it could possibly be there then at that time. And then I'm back up past the Falklands, back up the Atlantic, across the equator, the Azores, and back up the River Shannon, up to Kilrush.
Sounds like a thing of nothing there, the way you describe it. How long will that take you?
I estimate 8 to 10 months. All going well, yeah?
I'm just looking here. You're living in Annisgall, which is quite fitting. There's a spirit of exploration in that place, the home of Tom Crean.
Yeah. Annisgall would be famous for Tom Crean, yeah.
Yeah.
The South Pole, yeah.
Yeah. Can you... Why are you doing it?
Why? That's a brilliant question. I suppose lifelong ambition, really. I suppose I grew up watching my dad doing long-distance offshore trips, and he did a double Atlantic, and I suppose if you love sailing, it's the ultimate sailing challenge is to sail around the world, to do it solo non-stop, even better, you know? So,
Okay, let's get in...
Why not do something...
Let's get into specifics then. So how will you sleep, for example?
Sleep? Well, I'll have a self-steering system on the boat, which will keep me... sailing, and you know, I don't have to physically or manually steer the boat. Mm-hmm. So, I also have an AIS alarm that if another ship comes near me, it'll wake me. I have a quite a loud alarm. So, if weather and if I'm in a quiet area out of the shipping and fishing lanes, I can sleep for a good period of time. In one go. There'll be times when I can just grab pieces of sleep, but in general I should be able to get a good few hours at a time, or a few hours anyway. So, yeah, I'll keep track of my time, because I don't want to be sleep deprived either. You know, it's not good.
And what about eating? What will you eat?
I love my food, so I got to try and get as much variety as possible. Freeze dried would be kind of a good source of food. Especially if the weather gets bad or if it gets rough, but more or less any long life food I can. Canned food, pasta's pretty good. Packets, jars, as much as I can. As I say, much variety. By the time as the trip goes on, it'll probably get more boring, or I'll eat all the nice stuff first, you know.
And have you got some of this stuff that all you have to do is add water, and suddenly you've a spaghetti bolognese dish in front of you?
Oh, yeah, sorry, that is the freeze-dried meals.
Oh, that's the freeze-dried, right, yes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, just it's a Ziploc packet. You pour in the water and leave it for 8 to 10 minutes, and you've a pretty good meal now. I've been eating them every day for the last 10 days, trying them out, but they're good. They're surprisingly nice.
Will you fish?
Unlikely, I'd say, Ray. I don't think you'd get... you'd be going too fast for starters, and the weather, and it's not. I don't think it's practical.
That was a listener's question. Just so you know, it wasn't my question. Just I'm distancing myself from that question.
My dad used to get flying fish on the deck, and
wow,
I think he used to eat them.
Right, So they didn't even have to fish; they just came to him. That's nice.
Yeah.
What's the longest you've been at sea before? Somebody wants to know.
The longest I've been at sea, I work at sea. I deliver boats for people as well, locally and internationally. So I've sailed from all over Europe, Greece, Italy, France, to Ireland. The longest period on my own, I don't know. I couldn't say.
Right.
But this trip will definitely be the longest I've ever done. So that should be interesting.
Brings us nicely on to, does not being on solid land for so long have a bad effect? For example, when you land back in, up the Shannon or whatever you're going to, get off the ship at the end of it all, will you be able to walk? Because you have your sea legs, and then you get on, your land legs will be all wobbly, will they?
Yeah, that happens even after a week.
Oh, does it, right?
I remember pulled into Minorca one time after going from, I think it was Greece or Sardinia, and it was like we were drunk. Because we had a pretty rough passage, and I don't drink, so you'd adjust fairly quickly to that.
Right, okay. So you've no worries in that. Listen, I know you're looking for sponsors, so we're going to direct people towards Peter Lawless, circumnavigation.com. Peter Lawless, solo circumnavigation.com. Better get the solo in. And we'll talk to you when you're there, when you're on the high seas, and we look forward to talking to you on your satellite phone or whatever form of communication you have.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, that'd be interesting. Yeah,
great.
I could keep you updated. Yeah,
brilliant. For the moment, Peter, thank you very much. Mind yourself.
Good man. Lovely to talk to you. Yeah, thank you.
Nice to talk to you too. That's it from us. Cormac and Sarah on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday evening.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.